got something for all you men.
The following program contains graphic material, including offensive language. Viewer discretion is advised.
Boot computer, list of today's guests, signing in chat room, lining up news articles, checking level, adjusting camera, secure wire connection, restart computer, checking video feed.
With all she's got to do, you'd think Nicole Sandler was a one-woman band. Well, she is, and she's ready for another show. And now, here's the Nicole Sandler Show on NicoleSandler.com.
So, it is Thursday, and it's the end of August, and it's miserably hot outside, and Hurricane Harvey is bearing down, threatening Texas, and the news is insane. And I turn on the TV this morning, and I see MSNBC has a video whiplash.
We cannot remain a force for peace in the world if we are not at peace with each other.
Believe me, we have plenty of anarchists. They don't want to talk about the anarchists.
A wound inflicted upon a single member of our community.
They've got clubs and they've got everything. Antifa!
Is a wound inflicted upon us all.
It is time to heal the wounds that divide us.
It's a very dishonest media, those people right up there.
A new unity based on the common values that unite us.
And I really think they don't like our country. I really believe that.
When one part of America hurts, we all hurt.
These are sick people.
And when one citizen suffers an injustice, we all suffer together.
I went to better schools than they did. I was a better student than they were. God.
We are one people with one home and one great flag.
I got the white supremacists, the neo-Nazi, I got them all in there.
We have no division too deep for us to heal.
Yeah, KKK, we have KKK. I got them all.
There is no challenge too great for us to conquer.
The only people giving a platform to these hate groups is the media itself.
Well, that's true, you know, because we have to, because it's news. But he's giving them a platform, too. I keep joking that your head, the only thing he said that is truthful is your head's going to spin. My head is spinning. So I made an executive decision today that I'm going to be taking a vacation. I'll call it a mental health week. So next week, I will not be here. I'll be here tomorrow, as usual, and then back a week from Tuesday, just to clear my head of all the dump, all the Trumps out there, all the news, all the stuff, because I think we all need to do that once in a while. My only regret is that I'm not going anywhere. I can't really afford to go on vacation. If I could, I'd be heading out to Los Angeles, and I'll tell you why in a second.
It's time for Amy Simon of She's History, the most dangerous women in America then and now.
Yes, so people who've been listening to this show for any amount of time recognize that. Amy Simon is used to come on the show weekly. She is a cultural historian. She's a playwright and performer. And her show is called She's History. Amy, you there?
Nice segue. Hi, Colin.
Hi, honey. How are you?
I'm choosing to be hopeful. How are you?
Okay, right now choosing to be hopeful. That's good. So the reason you haven't been back on the show lately is because you're working. You have a real job that ties you up during these hours. But I convinced you to take a few minutes out of your lunch break and come on and talk to us about what's happening this weekend. It's Women's Equality Day, isn't it?
Yes. August 26th is Women's Equality Day. It is the day that fabulous female former Congresswoman, the late, great Bella Abzug from New York, convinced Congress to set aside August 26th every year to celebrate and honor the day that we women won the right to vote in 1920. We didn't get it. They didn't give it to us. We fought tooth and nail and won it when the 19th Amendment, the Susan B. Anthony Amendment, passed in 1920.
And so to celebrate Women's Equality Day, you've got two shows, two performances of your the one woman version of She's History, right? Explain to people who haven't been with us for so long, who haven't heard from you lately, all about She's History, how it came about and what it is.
Okay, well, I have been a feminist since I was 14 years old, and I turned into a playwright when I popped a couple of humans out of me. They happened to be girls. And I wrote my first play called Cheerios in My Underwear and Other True Tales of Motherhood. And I began my little journey of researching the role of mothers and motherhood in our society. And then when my girls got older, my 10-year-old daughter, Rose, came home from school one March, which is Women's History Month, and told me she was planning on doing her women's history report on Cher or Janet Jackson. So I flipped, of course, and that happened to be around the same time that I was going through a really horrible divorce and became, unfortunately, acquainted with the very sexist and corrupt family legal system. Couldn't believe how women were still being treated. And around that time, Hillary Clinton was making her first run for president. So around 2007, I was going through all this stuff, and I went to the library, back to the library, where I had spent years doing research for my first play. And I was looking actually for a book about women's rights, and I was directed to an aisle with the W. So I found a book called Women's Progress in America. And I turned to the W page because it was an alphabetical listing of women, events, and people. And I was looking for women's rights, but on the page I saw a picture of a woman named Victoria Woodhull, the prostitute who ran for president in 1872. They called her Mrs. Satan. And she asked Frederick Douglass, the famous black abolitionist, to be her running mate. And I saw Hillary Clinton, Barack Obama, and I literally went down a rabbit hole. And during this time, I could not find a job. This was during the terrible economic depression of California, Los Angeles, where I live. And I ended up working on a play. I wrote my first essay called Hillary Ran, and I started to research all the many women who run for president that we don't know anything about. And literally, I was like Alice down the rabbit hole. And ever since then, I have been researching, studying, performing, writing about, extolling the virtues of all these wonderful women. And I started my first play, She's History, the solo play, in 2009, 2010,
wow.
when wow. I really got it on stage. Yeah, and I've been doing it ever since, and I keep tweaking it and making it better. And 3 years ago, I joined Theater West, which is a wonderful theater company here in Los Angeles, the longest-running theater company, with the idea to bring the play to create an all-female version, a large cast for all the women to play all the different parts for two reasons. One, because as much as I was doing the show, I was doing it around the country and doing it for military bases and women's museums and all kinds of places, but not very many schools, which is my goal. It's hard to get a booking for a solo play, especially of this nature, because most of the people that need it don't have the money to afford to bring me in, and I needed to, you know, be paid. Mm-hmm. So I just started to work on an all-female cast version of it, and I thought this is a better way to get the stories out and also give women lots of parts to play, because our stages, like our society, does not represent women. Women's plays aren't being produced. Women's stories aren't being told, just like in the media, on TV, in the movies, in the government, in every facet of society.
Right.
So I remain a completely neurotic, obsessed women mother on a mission to you know, celebrate women.
So this weekend, Saturday and Sunday, you're doing two shows, one Saturday night at 8 p.m., Sunday at 2 p.m. at Theater West in Los Angeles. It's a benefit for Theater West, and it's celebrating Women's Equality Day. I want people who are in Los Angeles listening to go, because it's such a wonderful show. I've seen some video of it. I've yet to see the entire show, but
I know
it sucks that I'm in Florida. But our pal Gotta Laugh has seen it a few times and just raves. So how can people get tickets? How can they go see you?
Just go to sheshistory.com. But I also want to mention to the listeners in Los Angeles, this is a benefit for Theater West, but I do have half-price tickets on LA Stage Tix and Gold Star. And if anybody has any problems getting tickets, go to my website, and my phone number's there. Just give me a call, and I'll hook you up, because I just think theater in general is just so prohibitive. It's so expensive, and I don't want anybody not to be able to see a play because they can't afford it. And kids 10 and up are free on Sunday.
Kids 10 and up? 10 to
yep.
What, to 18?
I 10 mean, years old. Yeah. 10,
okay.
10 until they're in, 10 to 18, they're free on Sunday.
Okay.
So come on down. It's a really nice theater. There's about 150 seats, so there's plenty of room.
And this is a great thing to bring your daughter to. Again, you wrote it. It's
and
an
your
all,
son.
And your son. You're absolutely.
Your son.
And your son and your husband. But it is empowering for women, because so many of the stories that you tell, we don't learn about. For instance, you mentioned Victoria Woodhull. We've got time if you can spare a few more minutes.
I'll tell a couple stories. Victoria Woodhull. What a story about her. She was born in the 1830s. To a fanatically religious, like Mel Gibson, crazy family. And she only was educated till about the third grade, and she was always a real character. She had a photographic memory, and she would talk to the spirits. Back in those days, there was all this talk of seances and talking to people that are dead, and she claimed to do that, and that really served her later, because she ended up at the age of 15 marrying to escape from her crazy family. Her father was like, they talked that he was abusive to his children. Half of them ran away. She did physical labor so much. She was such a broken little girl that at the age of 15, she was so ill that a doctor came to treat her. Well, she ended up marrying this 28-year-old doctor who turned out to be an abusive alcoholic man. They moved up to San Francisco because it was the gold rush. She ends up having a baby at the age of 16 while he's sitting in a bar getting drunk. I mean, her story is amazing. She had no education, and choices for women to make money in those days were so few, especially if you weren't educated. So she ended up being a seamstress, making like $3 a week. She's sewing the costume of a famous actress in San Francisco. She starts to chat with her, and ends up, the actress says to her, "You're absolutely beautiful. You know, why aren't you on a stage?" And she ends up getting on a stage in San Francisco. Now, when you're a stage actress in the 1850s, San Francisco, Barbary Coast, home of the topless waitress, you end up doing a lot more than acting.
Mm.
And that's how she got her reputation as a prostitute who ran for president. So she ends up leaving the stage. She leaves her husband. She goes back to Ohio, where she was from. She hooks up with her crazy family and her sister. They cross the country doing as a traveling medicine show. I mean, I could go on for hours about what actually happened. But the whole family was involved in a lot of shady stuff. Her sister ended up being chased out of town for treating somebody for cancer and killing them with these crazy concoctions that they would make. They were literally a traveling medicine show. Well, the crazy father gets them to New York City, and they end up visiting Cornelius Vanderbilt, the richest man in America, because he was known to believe in seances, and his mother had recently died, and he wanted to talk to her, and he like carried a picture of her in his breast pocket, and he was also known to open the door to anyone that knocked on his door. So the father, who was a schemer and a smart man, but evil, He brings his two gorgeous daughters, Victoria and her sister Tennessee, was her name, beautiful girls. They show up in their finery in a carriage, all planned. He opens the door. Turns out the sister Tennessee turns out to be his mistress, and Victoria turns out to be his financial advisor.
Wow.
And the reason she ends up being able to advise him financially, and she's talking to his mother and all these dead people, is that while they're in New York City, the story is just too good to be, it's amazing, this stuff, you can't make it up. The sisters are treating all the prostitutes in New York City. And in the 1850s, the reason there's 50,000 prostitutes in New York City was because during the Civil War, so many soldiers have died that they left all these widows.
Mm.
And there was a captain, his name was Hooker. Well, Captain Hooker goes to New York City, and all the women follow him. And that's how they ended up being called hookers. Isn't that a crazy little tangent of a story? So there's all these hookers in New York City, and Victoria and Tennessee end up treating them. Well, the hookers are their clients are the bankers. So they're listening to these Wall Street guys talk about the stocks. They tell the story to Victoria Woodhull. She goes into a trance and tells Cornelius Vanderbilt what to do. He does it, and they all make a ton of money.
Wow.
This is actually true. She ends up making $700,000 on, it was 1829, the day the stock market folded. She makes $700,000 and ends up opening the first all-female stock brokerage firm on Wall Street. Now she's rich and loaded. She's married again. She opens the door one day to her beautiful home. It's her ex-husband, who's now a morphine addict. She brings him in. She now has two daughters. And at one point, she's living with her husband, her ex-husband, and sleeping with her biographer. And this is why no one ever, right? You can't make this stuff up.
Right, and we don't learn this in the history books. Okay, so keep going.
Well, yeah, this story. So she, at this, by this point, she's now been the first woman in America to address the Senate Judiciary Committee in Washington because she hooks up with a guy who helps her write a speech. Now, every year for years, Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Susan B. Anthony have been trying to get the 19th Amendment passed. By then, it wasn't the 19th Amendment. It was the 14th, the 15th, the 16th, for women to vote. But nobody would listen to either one of them. Every year, they'd go down to Washington and try to present their case to Congress, but they ignore Susan B. Anthony and Elizabeth Cady Stanton. But this gorgeous Victoria Woodhull shows up with a beautifully written speech that she memorized because she can do that, and she addresses the Congress. And they end up writing up her, it's called the Woodhull Memorial. And she says, based on the 14th Amendment, this is a great story I tell, Michelle, how if you're born a citizen in America, you're allowed to vote, that women already had the right to vote because they were born as citizens in America. But, of course, you couldn't vote or hold property unless you were a white male. Anyway, it doesn't pass or anything, but she becomes very popular around the women until they start to get a hold of her radical. She was the first person in America to print Karl Marx's manifesto because she ran her own newspaper. I mean, her story, her family was crazy. They went on a big trial. There was a scandal. She ended up in jail. She ran for president. She announces herself for president in 1872. And if anyone wants to Google the first woman to run for president, you'll see her. Well, she ended up getting arrested on Election Day and spent it in jail. First of all, she was only 34 years old, and you need to be 35 years old to actually get on the ballot.
Yes.
But she was the first woman to run, and they put her in jail because she exposed the affair of the most powerful and popular preacher of the day, Henry Ward Beecher. So she ends up in jail. She also would print stories about rape and all kinds of inequalities to women. I mean, she was such an amazing radical reformer, and she didn't care. She slept around. She talked about it. She did what all the men did, but, you know, she was a woman. So she ended up getting, you know, tossed out of the country. Her story is just tragic, you know. But she ends up going over to England. She and her sister sort of get bribed out of the country when Cornelius Vanderbilt dies. The brother and the family give them a ton of money to get them out of town because she had so many bad stories about them. So they go over to England and they tell everyone that they're, like, related to George Washington. And they both end up marrying these noble people. And she did wonderful things, though, like she opened schools for disadvantaged kids. I mean, the truth is she was incredibly, insanely radical and wild, but she did wonderful things for women. And that's really just one of the stories that I tell in the show. I don't go into that much detail about it. The truth is the first time I wrote the play, I had 30 minutes just on Victoria Woodhull, and the show was 90 minutes, which is too long for a solo show. It's 75 minutes now.
And so who else is in it? You mentioned Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Susan B. Anthony.
Susan B. Anthony. Yeah, there's about 30 different women. A lot of them I just talk about, show pictures of, tell stories, and about 9 of them I portray. And I'm going to tell one that's really relevant now, and it's about Sojourner Truth. And for people who don't know, Sojourner Truth was a former slave and a preacher, and she was born in 1797 into slavery in New York City. And her name was Isabella Bomfrey. She was sold at the age of 9 with a flock of sheep, taken from her family and sold. And then at the age of 13, she was sold again for 70 pounds. When she was 29 years old, she ran away because slavery was abolished by then in New York. She gets a job without pay for a family as a servant. She meets a religious missionary. She has this religious awakening and becomes a traveling preacher. And she goes around the country preaching, like many of them back then, first about religion, then slavery, then abolition. She changes her name. Her name means traveling preacher. That's what Sojourner Truth means.
Mm-hmm.
And so, but back in 1848, Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Lucretia Mott, whose story I can't tell now, I don't have enough time, they have the first women's rights convention in 1848 in Seneca Falls, New York. They fight like hell. They get Frederick Douglass, who our president thinks is still doing well,
yes,
by the way, I might add.
Yes, he's finally getting recognized for all his great work, right?
Yeah. I put that joke in the show now. It's just too funny. And I'm always trying to find something funny to say in the show. The show has a lot of comedy in it because we have to laugh.
Of course.
Anyway, Elizabeth Cady Stanton stands up at the Seneca Falls Convention, demands the right to vote. They create this thing called the Declaration of Sentiments, which is based on the Declaration of Independence, our founding fathers' little list of grievances against King George. The ladies just substituted men for King George. All men and women are created equal. And they end up getting this Declaration of Sentiments printed in the New York in a big newspaper. And so that was 1848. And all these women's rights conventions start popping up all over the country. Like, they really turned it around. It was a very significant thing, Seneca Falls. So 1851, Sojourner Truth gets invited to this really big women's rights convention in Akron, Ohio. She gets invited by this very cool white woman named Frances Gage. So she goes to this convention, and on the second day, all these white men, these preachers, it's in a church, they don't understand why women want equal rights. They're like, why should women want equal rights? They have the best place everywhere. They are helped into carriages and lifted over ditches and mud puddles. Meanwhile, Sojourner Truth is this very big, strong, imposing. She was like a really good slave because she was so big. So she's tall and imposing, and she's hanging out at the back of the church, and she starts to make her way up the aisle to make a speech. And she's being yelled at, "Go home, darky," and all this stuff. And Frances Gage is like, "Let her speak, let her speak." She comes up onto the stage, and she makes her speech, and it's the very famous, iconic, "Ain't I a Woman" speech. And she's, you know, just... And the thing about her that I always impress in the play is that she never scolded anybody. Sojourner Truth turned so many people around. She really heard from God. She was a very spiritual person. I mean, her children were sold into slavery. She was beaten. Her life was tragic, but she found God, and she went around the country. She met President Lincoln. I mean, she was amazing, and she stands up there in front of all these white religious people, and she says, "Well, no one ever helped me in the carriage or lifted me over a ditch, and ain't I a woman?" And she's got a smile on her face, and she has this beautiful, soft-spoken, amazing way of reaching out to people. And I don't want to do the whole speech for you right now. Come see the show, and you can see it. But she turns them all around. And, you know, by the end of it, she's like, you know, "Well, you know, the first woman God ever made," which is Eve, "was strong enough to turn all these women around," because that's what the preachers are saying. "Well, Eve did this and Eve did that." She's like, "Well, you men ought to let them have their way." You know, she just had a way about her. And I tell this story because we're so fractured today. And all my research on women's rights, women learned how to organize by helping to free the slaves. And there were so many men that helped women achieve that goal. You know, a lot of times I have men come to the play being dragged by their wives. And at the end of it, they're like, "I really like that. That was really good." There's no man bashing in the play. It's really just celebrating activism and social justice and, you know, all that kind of good stuff. So it's a very celebratory, it's very empowering. At the end of the play, people are all motivated. You know, I've had people say to me, "Where do I join a group?" You know, we can get stuff done when we join together. And,
yes, we can.
You know, we're such a mess today. But, you know, if you look in history, we've really hurt each other, but we've really come together and accomplished good things.
Amy Simon, the show is called She's History, The Most Dangerous Women in America, Then and Now. It's playing Saturday and Sunday this weekend. Saturday is Women's Equality Day at Theater West
West
in Hollywood.
In Los Angeles.
And
it's between the Hollywood Bowl and Universal Studios. It's right there in L.A.
Okay. And all the details are at sheshistory.com. She's History. There's no apostrophe, just sheshistory.com. And call Amy. She'll tell you where you can get half-price tickets, too. Bring your kids. It's free for kids 10 and up. And
on Sunday. On Sunday.
On Sunday at 2 p.m. That's the matinee. Amy Simon, it's so good to talk with you and to hear these stories again.
Oh, it's great to talk to you, too.
All right, call me off the air. We'll talk later.
You bet I will. Okay.
All right. Thanks, Amy.
You bet. Bye-bye.
Bye. Amy Simon, yes, she's a cultural historian. Amy used to come on and tell us stories every week. She'd tell another one. And, you know, sometimes you got to work. I get it. All right, we'll take a break. Come back on the other side with Howie Klein next.
It's time for Nicole Sandler's What's News from NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
The nation is recovering from presidential whiplash sustained over the past few days as Trump delivered three speeches in the course of 48 hours.
What a difference a day makes. Well, a day, a speechwriter, and a teleprompter. President Trump today speaking to veterans in Reno, reading from prepared remarks on a teleprompter calling for national unity.
It is time to heal the wounds that divide us and to seek a new unity based on the common values that unite us.
Heal the wounds, seek a new unity, common values that unite us. Normally strong words that few would take issue with, except when these words are coming from the mouth of President Trump, many Americans now wonder what, if anything, do they really mean? Just last night, the president stood before a crowd of supporters in Phoenix and revealed once again just how far he'll go, how much he'll bend the truth, whose memory he'll sully, who he'll attack, even within his own party. Sometimes he does this to try to cover up the fact that he made a mistake, which, as we all know, he never owns up to. Sometimes he does it because he clearly thinks of himself as a victim of Republicans, reporters, leaking staffers, Democrats, and just about everyone else. Donald Trump, the world's biggest victim, trapped inside the body of the world's most powerful man.
On Monday, from Fort Myer, Virginia, he took on the role of commander-in-chief, outlining, with virtually no detail, our path forward in Afghanistan. Then he was off to Phoenix Tuesday for a campaign rally where he ranted and raved for 75 minutes or so, sowing division in an off-the-cuff and off-teleprompter rambling address that was supposed to be about unity. And on Wednesday, in Reno, Nevada, the president addressed the American Legion's 99th National Convention, this time seemingly never veering from the script. He attempted to walk back the vitriol he spewed just 18 hours earlier.
Speaking to military veterans in Reno, it was a more presidential Trump.
We have no division too deep for us to heal. And there is no enemy too strong for us to overcome.
We are one people with one home and one great flag. We are not defined by the color of our skin, the figure on our paycheck, or the party of our politics. We are defined by our shared humanity, by our citizenship in this magnificent nation, and by the love that fills our hearts. And I know I speak for all of you when I say our hearts beat for America. Our souls fill with pride every time we hear the national anthem. This is the spirit we need to overcome our challenges, to pursue our common destiny, and to achieve a brighter future for our people. We will win. Watch. We will win.
Despite his words of unity, Trump continued to wage war with lawmakers in Congress, vowing a face-off over his proposed border wall. Tuesday night in Phoenix, he said,
"And we are building a wall on the southern border, which is absolutely necessary." Build that wall. Now, the obstructionist Democrats would like us not to do it, but believe me, if we have to close down our government, we're building that wall.
Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer issued a statement, quote, "If the president pursues this path against the wishes of both Republicans and Democrats, as well as the majority of the American people, he will be heading towards a government shutdown which nobody will like and which won't accomplish anything." And Speaker of the House Paul Ryan stated,
well, I don't think a government shutdown is necessary, and I don't think most people want to see a government shutdown.
When Congress returns from recess, they have two major issues to grapple with, the debt ceiling and a spending bill. The Treasury Department has estimated that the government will reach its borrowing limit in October, at which point Congress will have to vote to increase the debt limit in order to avoid a default. And the government will run out of money on October 1st unless Congress approves a new spending bill. Trump is also apparently following up on his tweets from July 26th, which effectively reinstated a ban on transgender military service that had been lifted the year before under President Obama. The White House is expected to send guidance to the Pentagon on how to implement a new ban, issuing a policy that would allow Secretary of Defense Jim Mattis to consider a service member's ability to deploy in deciding whether to kick them out of the military. In the midst of all this, the president's poll numbers continue to fall.
Quinnipiac University polls show the president's approval rating has dropped 4 points in their poll since last week, down to 35%. 59% disapprove of the job he's doing. 31% of voters feel President Trump is doing more to unite the country, down 5 points from after his first 100 days in April. 62% say he's doing more to divide the country. 45% say Trump is bringing the wrong type of change. That's up from 2 points in April. 30% feel it is the right type of change, down 4 points. 23% say there's been little change at all. And voters are against the way Trump talks about the media by a nearly 2-to-1 margin. 35% approve, 62% disapprove. At the same time, 40% approve of the media's coverage of Trump, while 55% disapprove.
And that's a bit of What's News for now. I'm Nicole Sandler. The Nicole Sandler Show and What's News are 100% listener funded. To help support us, please visit NicoleSandler.com/donate.
Can't afford a monthly donation? Is that what's getting you down, Bunky?
But maybe you shop on Amazon.com occasionally?
Well then, just use the NicoleSandler.com Amazon portal, and we'll get a small commission on all your purchases.
But I just bought...
Don't worry, we can't see what you bought.
Just bookmark Amazon through the NicoleSandler.com portal and use it. Every purchase helps Nicole stay on the air.
Are you a multinational corporation hungry for a treat? Well, come on down to Schmucky Chucky's, where you'll personally be seated by Chuck Schumer himself.
So many dishes, and they're all fresh.
You're gonna love our Blue Dog special, the Dino Burger, because we say so.
A good hamburger and french fries.
And every burger comes with a side order of...
grits. I love grits. I love anything with corn. It's corn.
All for only $50,000. Wash it all down with a Dirty Debbie.
9/10 water, 1/10 orange juice. After a week or two, you drink this, it's 200 calories and it's acetic.
And wipe your mouth with a tissue print of Glass-Steagall. For dessert, try our DNC tarts.
Little cookies, tell the quality of that.
Most restaurants give you a mint, but at Schmucky Chucky's, you get complimentary.
Sweet and low.
Who picks up the tab for all this? Find out now with Howie Klein of DownWithTyranny.com on The Nicole Sandler Show.
Hi, Howie Klein.
Hey, how are you, Nicole?
I'm doing just fine. And you?
I'm good, too. And I don't know if you know this person I'm going to mention, but you may. I have a feeling if you don't know her personally, you probably have heard of her.
Okay.
And she reached out to me the other day after many decades. And when I knew her, she was the main music person. She was the music director of KLOL in Houston. Her name is Dana Steele.
Sure.
Does that sound
familiar? Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
Exactly. So, and the reason I'm bringing this up is because she is running for Congress.
Oh, that is awesome. You know, she's always been out there. She's one who steps up and has always been very outspoken. And she's a tough cookie. That's such great news. Now, is she still in
and
the
she's
Houston
been
area?
Very, very successful in her post. She was known in Houston. I mean, that was the station in Houston,
yes.
Just like KLOS was in L.A.
Right.
Or WNEW was in New York.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, KSAN in San Francisco, but KLOL, which 101 FM, that was the station in Houston. And she was known as the first lady of rock and roll.
Right.
And it's been many, many years, of course, but she's been very, very successful since then. She's written like a dozen books,
yep.
Some of them very big books. And she's, you know, done like 3 TED Talks, and she's a motivational
wow.
speaker.
Yes.
And now she's running in a really, really crazy right-wing district. Do you remember
quite a few years ago, three Ku Klux Klan, you know, real Trump types, chained some black guy named Bird up to the back of their pickup truck, and they dragged him along until he died. Remember that incident?
Sadly, I do. Yeah.
Yes. That's the district she's running in.
Oh, my.
Can you imagine? Poor Dana.
Well, you know what? She is. She's a great speaker. She's motivational. And that's a big part of it, being able to connect with people. And that's what she's done so successfully. So
exactly. Exactly. You should have her on the show.
I would love to.
That the two of you could bond on a lot of things,
obviously.
Oh, my
goodness. I would love to. Yeah, I didn't know her well. We had met at, you know, at a radio convention or two, and I really liked her. But that's as far as I know her. It wasn't like she was a great friend, but I always had so much respect for her because she was always so good at what she did.
And she was, you know, I don't have to tell you, the rock and roll radio business was very male-oriented male-dominated. So it was always a little bit difficult for women to rise to their full potential. Women who did had to be better than men, which is unfair. But she did. She was always at the very top of the game. I mean, anyone you mention her to from the music business of her era knows her immediately.
Oh, yeah.
Whether they know her well or not is something else, but everyone knows who she is.
Well, that's great news. Yes, please do put me in touch with her. I'd love to reconnect and definitely get her on the show.
Will do. Yeah. I'll be happy to. I'm just writing about her now, and when you called just now, I was literally sitting and writing, and I was watching this TED talk she did about teach your children well from Crosby, Stills, Nash and Young, which was funny because my label Reprise put out a Crosby, Stills, Nash and Young album late in the game. And someone is writing a book about them, and they called me yesterday, and, you know, basically I said, look, I don't really remember much about this. It's a long time ago, and it wasn't a successful record, and I don't have a lot of recollection of it. I said, would you like to talk about the Velvet Underground record that we put? I remember that.
Or Neil Young, right? You did a lot with Neil Young. You could have talked about
that we put the record out because of Neil Young. I mean,
sure.
It was, you know, the way I looked at it, I used to love Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young. Obviously, mm-hmm. when I was a kid, it was a really big deal for me. But then after that, it was all about Neil Young. And he was one of the, you know, premier artists on Reprise, the label that I was running. And when he came to me and said, I'm going to get together with Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young again and do a big tour, would you guys put the record out? I said, absolutely, we'll put the record out. I mean, the worst that could happen is it's not a big success, but the tour, of course, would generate gigantic sales of Neil's catalog, which it did. And the record wasn't a success, but overall, it was a successful venture both for our artists, who made him happy, and for us, because we sold lots of Neil catalog.
Right. Now, that wasn't the Living with War tour, was it? That was after, wasn't it?
I think they called it the Heartland Tour.
Okay, yeah, this was a different one because they toured once after that for Neil's record, Living with War, and Crosby, Stills, and Nash toured with him on, I don't think they played on the record, but they toured with him on it. And that was after, I think that was after.
Years later.
Years later. Yeah. Ah, music stuff.
So it was funny because when the writer, you know, the writer is writing a book, he needed information.
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't really give him anything. I mean, you know, he's asking me very specific things about if I remember the negotiations. And I mean, I didn't even remember this. He started reading me a transcript of me speaking at introducing Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young at Madison Square Garden.
Oh,
I didn't even remember I ever did that. And he had this transcript of it. So I said, why don't you call Dana Steele? She's running for Congress now. It'll be easy for you to talk to her, and she'll know this stuff. This is right up her alley.
Right. Oh, good idea. That's great.
I don't know if that's going to ever happen. But anyway, so I'm my head is a little bit there in this bizarre Houston district that Trump won by 75%.
Wow.
But much happier. On a much happier note, this morning at 6 a.m., the guy who we've been, you know, begging to run for Congress in the other Maine district. So Maine has two congressional districts. One is basically Portland and Augusta,
mm-hmm.
and it's the southeast part of the state. It's very, 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 very liberal in every way. It's a real, you know, blue, deep, deep blue district. And
Hillary won that district overwhelmingly, and because of that, she won the state. However, the other congressional district, which is the biggest congressional district, I believe the biggest congressional district in size east of the Mississippi, it's basically the whole state of Maine except that little tiny first congressional district of Maine. So it's the entire state. It's very, very rural. And goes up into virgin woods right up along the Canadian border, and it's kind of the conservative district, and Trump did win it, so he won one electoral vote out of the four that Maine has by winning that one district, and it was held by a blue dog for a very long time, who wasn't very good, and then a Republican won it named Bruce Poliquin, and he holds it now. And the DCCC has been running this awful candidate against him. And I don't know why they don't learn. When you run an awful candidate once and they're terrible and they do terribly, and chances are when you run them again, they'll do worse, which is exactly what happened. And so fortunately that candidate has gone on to be the head of Emily's List now or something. And so she isn't running again. And we've been trying to talk this guy into running who's, you know, arguably the most progressive member of the legislature, or at least of the House of Maine's House of Representatives, and he's the majority whip. The Democrats control that House, and he's the majority whip and the assistant majority leader. And this is the guy that passes all the cutting edge bills. He's the one that writes the bills to help veterans, to increase the minimum wage, all of the good stuff. Whether some of it succeeds and some of it doesn't, but he's the one behind all of the good legislation that they're working on in Maine. And, you know, obviously we'd love to see someone like that in Congress, not just because he's going to vote well, which he will, but also because he's a leader. And that's what we need. He's a young, smart, really smart as a whip leader. And he also happens to have been an active duty Marine who served both in Afghanistan and in Iraq. And that doesn't in and of itself mean that you're going to be necessarily great. But when you combine that kind of skill set with the political skill set that he's already proven in the Maine legislature, and you're a diehard progressive on issues, then you're looking at another someone who's going to be like Ted Lieu or something, because it's the same background. Ted Lieu, a military guy who's a progressive who went to the state legislature, made a name for himself as the most progressive member of the California State Senate, and then went on to Congress, where he's now one of the best members. And when I look at this guy who's running in Maine, whose name, by the way, is
Jared Golden. Jared Golden.
Thank you. Jared Golden, exactly. I keep getting Jared mixed up with
the other one.
Jared Golden. So Jared did a guest post for Down with Tyranny that ran at 6 o'clock this morning on 6 o'clock West Coast time. 6 o'clock East Coast time is when he announced with an incredible video. His announcement video is really, really powerful. It's one of those videos where you look at it and you can really like suddenly think, wow, this guy is great. Just like that one for Randy Bryce and just like that one for Amy McGrath. But like Randy Bryce, this guy is following it up with a great campaign that he started today. This is a very large district, and he's spending the next week going everywhere in the district where you can possibly go for a week and just meeting people, going to, you know, small towns. There's only one city in the district where they know him and love him. He's the representative from Lewiston. So they already know him there. So he's going up into the rural areas. He's going to work on a farm one day. He's going to work as doing lobster traps one day, just doing all the various things that people do and getting to know folks in these towns. And he is not shy about his progressive beliefs. That's what it's all about for him. And he is the perfect example of a guy who comes from a working family, working class roots. And his motivation for being in politics is that. And so it's a perfect match for Blue America. So we instantly endorsed him in the same minute that he announced his candidacy.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, no, I read this earlier, watched the video, and he looks terrific. Exactly what the Democrats need. You know, I saw a post from, I think it was Matthew Iglesias or something. And it said that as of now, the Democrats are projected to win 54% of the votes, the congressional votes, but win 47% of the seats. So more than ever, we need people to vote, and we need great candidates to get them out to vote. And what we talk about, it seems, every week is the DCCC putting up these candidates who don't inspire anyone to get out and vote. In order to overcome the gerrymandering, we need to get more than 50% of the vote. We need, you know, double that. It would be nice to get 100%.
In a rural district like Maine's 2nd Congressional District, you have to have a candidate. You know, Hillary lost that district. There's a reason. I mean, Obama won the district. Democrats have won that district for decades, presidential candidates. But Hillary was the wrong candidate. I'm not trying to put her down right now. I'm just saying it's a different mentality. They need someone who is of the working class in this district. It's a white working class district, as they call it, but very open to Democrats. Obama won it both times handsomly, and there's no reason in the world why Jared shouldn't be able to win this thing. And there was no reason in the world why the candidate that the DCCC thrust on the Democratic Party last time, this woman Emily Kane, there was no reason why she would have won. She had nothing to do with this district like this. She's different. I mean, her whole thing is you know, she might have won it in the Portland district. That might have been a good district for her. That's really more what she was all about. But they're not the same. And the DCCC should be professional enough in what they do to know that, to understand why Maine's 1st district and Maine's 2nd district are very, very different and require different candidates. But they don't know that. I mean, I see it here in California, where they're trying to mix and match people in districts that they don't live in and have nothing to do with. And to them, it's all the same. They look at Orange County and they say, yeah, we'll put him there and her there and him there and her there. And with no rhyme or reason, except their own ideas of, you know, this is how we make sure this candidate wins and this is how we protect that candidate. And they're not thinking about the people in the district and what they need. And that's the only thing that should be going into this. That's the only consideration that should be made. And that's the last consideration that the DCCC will ever make when they're you know, manipulating who's running where. So now we wind up with a bunch of inappropriate candidates who don't even live in the damn districts they're running in. And in some cases, well, you say, well, it's the same county. How different could it be? I'll tell you how different it could be. This is how different it can be. Here's this guy who won the lottery. He was a Republican until 2015. He won the. He, you know how, like, when Trump opens his mouth, you get a lie.
Yes.
I mean,
every
time Trump to say something and it not be a lie is a rarity.
Mm-hmm.
Anything he says, you have to assume it's a lie until it's proven otherwise. Well, this guy is the same way. His name is Gil Cisneros. All he does is lie. He says, I was a Bernie supporter. He's trying to claim he was a Bernie supporter. So how hard is it to just take a look at his record of contributions? Notice that he donated close to $200,000 to Hillary Clinton during the campaign. During the primary.
Right.
So just during the primary, when he's claiming he was a Bernie guy, a couple of hundred grand to Hillary. Nothing to Bernie. Zero. No, not one penny. So there's a lie. And then when someone calls him out on it, he says, it was a joint account. My wife did it. I didn't know anything about it. Well, he's a liar.
Right.
And then he thinks he can tell you that, oh, yeah, I left the Republican Party decades ago. I haven't been a Republican in 20 years. Really? How about in 2015 when he registered to be a Democrat for the very, very first time?
Ooh.
2015 isn't 20 years ago. It's like if I do the math carefully, it comes to me that it's like 2 years ago.
Yeah.
So there's one zero less. I mean, that's who this guy is. In any case, he lives in a $10 million mansion on the beach in one of the richest towns in America, a town I had never even heard of before, called Newport Coast. I mean, everyone knows Newport Beach, but Newport
is where the really, really rich people from already one of the richest places lives. And the district that he is running in, that the DCCC put him in, is nowhere near there. It's all the way the other side. It's a landlocked district on the other side of Orange County in the northeast part of the county. And it's much more of a working class district. It includes Hacienda Heights in Los Angeles, mm-hmm. which is strictly working class. It includes a working class part of San Bernardino County.
Wow.
And it's literally the blue collar part of Orange County. Right. And they're putting some guy who lives in a $10 million mansion in a town that is like a joke, because it's only for like the very, 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 very wealthy. I mean, what a silly, silly thing to do. But that's the DCCC. That's who they are. And what is and why is this guy, his name, like I said, is Gil Cisneros. Why is he even a candidate? What is his qualifications? I mean, this is a guy. I mean, I know you're going to think I'm making this up. I'm not making this up. This is true. He worked at Frito-Lay's as a potato chip taster. That's what he was doing for a living. He was tasting potato chips.
Oh, my God.
And he won
How
the lottery.
He
won $266 million in the lottery. And the DCCC looks at that and they say, oh, he's qualified to be in Congress.
Wow. Wow. Well, there's a woman named Mavis Wanzek in Massachusetts now. I guess they'll go after her. She won the Powerball last night.
Yes, I'm sure they. But you know what's horrible? Not only will they go after her, the Republicans probably will too.
Oh, I'm sure, because they can self-fund. That seems to be the qualification they're looking for.
You know, it's funny you should say that. I just finished a story. I think it's going up tonight on my blog about self-funders. And when you look at the self-funders, for example, I did last cycle. So the 2016 election. So people who ran for Congress as self-funders, there were lots of Democrats and lots of Republicans. The Republicans won. Republicans like self-funders. I mean, mm-hmm. the Republican voters like self-funders. To them, it makes a lot of sense. Someone is really rich. Hey, they should be the congressman because they're really rich. Good enough. And they're self-funding. They're great. That's how they wound up with Trump.
Right.
But the Democrats who also run self-funders all the time because of the DCCC, and they lose. I mean, one Democratic self-funder won, and he's not even a real Democrat. It's a horrible blue dog, Vicente Gonzalez from South Texas, and he's a blue dog. He votes with the Republicans. He's just the worst kind of Democrat you could ever ask for, and he's a multimillionaire. He spent I had the exact figure, but it's something like $2.25 million. To buy himself a seat.
Why? Why do they want to be in Congress so that they can help pass legislation to make themselves richer?
Possibly that. I mean, if you look at his voting record, he certainly didn't want to be in Congress to help working people because
right.
that's not what he's doing.
Amazing.
Who knows why they want to be in Congress? I don't have an look. One guy, this guy David Trone, spent over $13 million on a campaign, and he never got out of the primary. I think he came in fourth in the primary.
Oh, my God.
And guess what he's doing this year?
He's running again.
He thinks that, you know, he only spent $13 million last time. If he just spends $15 million this time, maybe he'll win.
Wow.
It's a different district, and he doesn't live in it. But, hey, he has all the money in the world.
You know, and there was a story this week, Howie, about how the DNC has less than half the cash on hand that the RNC has. Their fundraising numbers for June or July, I guess July, were abysmal. And they don't seem to get the message.
No, they don't get the message. There's no reason for anyone to give any money to the DNC at this point. So they're not getting money from the very wealthy people who they normally would get it from. Those people don't trust them anymore. Debbie Wasserman Schultz really destroyed the DNC as a functioning organization, and the break with her was too muddied for it to be. You know, they should have had a clean break. The Democratic Party, what they should really do is just denounce her and get her out of the party.
Mm-hmm.
But instead of doing that, you know, she was resigning and going over to the Hillary campaign and as a vice chairman of the Hillary campaign, so it's kind of looked like she was getting a reward for her
right.
bad behavior.
Yeah.
And you know, people aren't fools; they see what's going on, and they don't like it.
And that's why the DCCC isn't getting any money from the grassroots. People aren't donating to them. There's more and more people who are donating directly to candidates.
Good.
And they're leaving out the DNC.
Good.
And that's a good. That's a very, very good idea.
Yes, it is. Or through Blue America. Howie, we've got like 5 minutes left. Do you want to talk about this other story that you have up at downwithtyranny.com that's so horrific about Trump's new target?
Yes. I mean, I hope people will read that. I found out about it. You know, there was a New York Times story about it last week.
Right.
And then NPR did a really, really good piece about it as I was going for a drive, and I heard the whole thing. It was a pretty scary story. So Obama wanted to stop long-term care abuses. Health facilities,
right,
from forcing people who wanted to, you know, get in a nursing home, basically,
right,
to sign. They try to make them sign an agreement that there'll be no suing. They can't, no matter what happens to them, they can't sue. It'll go to arbitration. So that and Obama tried to get rid of that, and they finally passed a rule that would get rid of that. And the long-term care facilities don't like that, because if they get sued, that's public and that ruins their reputations. Now, what do they get sued for? Every single day. So we're not talking about something that happens once in a blue moon. We're talking about something that happens every day. Every day a senior gets abused or neglected, mm-hmm, in a long-term care facility somewhere.
Yeah.
For one reason or another. And the suits drive the industry insane. They go crazy over it, and they don't want trials. They want arbitrators. And I explained, or I had a lawyer who's running for Congress explain why that's preferential to the industry but bad for the seniors who are getting abused. They don't get justice. You know, the industry is the one who controls the arbitrators, and the arbitrators have a tendency to very, very marked tendency to side with the industry. So anyway, Trump comes along, and this very, very free spending lobbying group who represents the long-term care facilities talks him into getting rid of Obama's rule, which Trump always wants to get rid of anything that has to do with Obama,
yeah,
and making it so it you cannot under any circumstances sue one of these nursing homes for abuse, and there's a lot of elder abuse, or for neglect, where, I mean, they get bed sores from no one even turning them over. I mean, just terrible,
it's
kinds
horrible
of situations, and they're not allowed to sue if Trump's rule passes, which it's likely to pass. So I thought it would be a good thing to write about, not just for what it is in and of itself, which is pretty horrific, but just because this is what Trump is talking about when he says we're going to create jobs by getting rid of all these regulations.
Yeah.
What regulations? This is the kind of regulations he's getting rid of. There's hundreds of them in every field of life. There's regulations like this, and he doesn't want them, and his regime doesn't want them. And they are, while we're all watching the Trump clown show every day on TV, this is what they're doing behind the scenes.
It really is horrendous. I will link on my blog where I post the podcast to both those stories, the one about the nursing home, the elder abuse, and the Trump trying to do away with those regulations and make it so you can't sue a nursing home, which is amazing. And the one about Jared Golden as well, because you've got the video in there and he looks like such a great candidate. See, those are the kinds of people we need in Congress, and maybe we could stop these.
An introduction to both Jared and to Dana.
Oh, definitely, please. Yeah, Dana Steele. That's such great news. By the way, last week we talked about Derek Crowe, who Blue America officially endorsed this weekend, who's running in the Austin area and surrounding. If only the district were just Austin, he'd probably be a shoo-in.
You should look at the map of this district. I mean, it's so it was actually drawn by Tom DeLay with the sole purpose of negating the Democratic vote in Austin. That was the idea. So they take a nice chunk of downtown Austin, and then they dilute it by going way, way to the west into Texas Hill Country, making it and then a little tiny corridor that's sometimes like, you know, a mile wide that goes to the rich suburbs north of San Antonio. Very, very weirdly drawn district. But since it's been rejoined, it's changed somewhat, and now it's possible for a Democrat to win, especially a Democrat like Derek Crowe, who's a very, very, very impressive candidate.
Awesome. Well, Blue America PAC is got some great candidates going now, so this is it's getting exciting. These are the candidates we need. Howie Klein, find him at downwithtyranny.com, on Twitter at downwithtyranny, on Facebook, Howie Klein, and here on Thursdays. Thank you so much, Howie.
One more before you say goodbye. Can
yes.
I say one more thing?
Yep.
So I do a few of these radio things every week.
Yeah.
And this one, even though they on the clock, they say they're the same length. For some reason, this one goes by like half the time of any of the other ones. It just seems we're just getting started and we're saying goodbye.
There you go. Well, time flies when you're having fun. Bye. Thanks, Howie. All right.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. We'll see you tomorrow.
It's Thursday, August 24, 2017.
It's sort of like home on the range where never is heard a discouraging word. And the coal dust isn't toxic all day.
Administration halts study on health impacts of mountaintop removal coal mining. New Orleans still grappling with flood emergency as potential hurricane brews in the Gulf of Mexico. Volkswagen is bringing back the iconic minibus, and this time it's electric. Plus, California again proves Trump wrong. Climate regulations actually boost economic growth.
Shocking. All of those stories and more straight ahead. From BradBlog.com, I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
We have become an energy exporter for the first time ever just recently.
That's true. If by recently he means May of 2011. Thanks, Obama. This is your Green News Report.
I'm gonna soak up the sun.
Okay, Desi Doyen, trouble in New Orleans with a hurricane heading its way?
Yeah, kind of. As we go to air, the National Hurricane Center is warning that a new storm, Harvey, is now brewing in the Gulf of Mexico and could drop insane amounts of rain on both Texas and Louisiana. And that's really bad news for the city of New Orleans, which has been in a state of emergency since an early August storm dumped nearly a foot of rain in just 4 hours, causing widespread flooding and forcing city officials to admit that some of the city's pumps have been offline for repairs during peak hurricane season.
Uh-oh.
Yep, now the New Orleans Advocate reports that city officials may evacuate the city if it is forecast to receive more than a foot of rain in a 24-hour period. And by the way, next week is the 12th anniversary of Hurricane Katrina.
Oh boy.
Meanwhile,
scientists are warning the administration's latest move may hurt more than help coal country.
The Trump administration's Interior Department has ordered the National Academies of Sciences to stop work on a study of the health impacts of mountaintop removal coal mining. Mountaintop removal coal mining is exactly like it sounds. It's a method that literally blasts off the tops of mountains, dumping the debris into valleys and streams below where people live. Numerous previous studies have linked mountaintop removal in West Virginia to elevated rates of cancer, heart disease, and birth defects. So state officials requested a federal assessment. Bob Kincaid, founder of West Virginia's Coal River Mountain Watch, in an interview on the broadcast, said the administration's decision to halt this health study shields the coal industry.
They were going to say that there does appear to be a scientific reason to be concerned about the harm that mountaintop removal coal extraction does to people who live near it. And that would have created a controversy and a storm that the coal industry could not have weathered.
Weird. So Donald Trump's claims about how much he loves coal miners is actually not true, because this study might have found that coal mining was killing coal miners and their families. Go figure.
And even worse than that, last week the Environmental Protection Agency announced that it will revoke an Obama-era rule that required operators of coal-fired power plants to limit toxic metals in their wastewater discharge. It seems like this administration really does not want to find out the impacts of coal pollution.
Drink up, coal miners.
But some good news. California's state economy is booming, even as the state has rolled out a host of new regulations to curb carbon emissions and fight climate change.
What?
According to a new report, after implementation of California's landmark cap-and-trade law, statewide per capita emissions fell by 12%. And at the same time, the state's per capita GDP grew at double the national average. For every one fossil fuel job, the state now has 8 renewable energy jobs. And since the launch of cap-and-trade, California now leads the nation in the number of clean energy patents and is now the most energy-productive economy in the world, meaning it uses the least amount of energy for every dollar of economic activity.
So when Donald Trump told us in Phoenix that the Paris Climate Accord would kill jobs, California made him a liar yet again?
Yes, it did.
Not hard to do.
Finally, it's official. German carmaker Volkswagen, while trying to redeem itself after being caught cheating on pollution standards in the U.S. and Europe, announced this week it is bringing back its iconic Volkswagen minibus in 2022. Only this time, that minibus will be all electric.
Cool. How about an electric bug? Where's that?
Hopefully coming soon.
Still waiting on you, Volkswagen. For much more on all of these stories and the many we couldn't get to today, check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. Don't forget, you can download our reports anytime via Stitcher, TuneIn, or iTunes. Find us, follow us, and share us worldwide on the Facebooks and the Twitters at Green News Report. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
Beep, 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 yeah! Beep, beep, beep.